Jake called to the stand his ex-secretary, Roxy Briscoe, who, since she had left the office with bad blood, had initially refused to testify. So Jake issued a subpoena and explained she might go to jail if she ignored it. She quickly came around and took the stand, dressed fashionably for the moment. Tag-teaming, they walked through the events of the morning of October 3rd, when she arrived at the office with the mail. She identified the envelope, letter, and two-page will from Seth Hubbard, and Judge Attlee admitted them into evidence as exhibits for the proponents. There was no objection from the other side. Following a script that had been suggested by His Honor, Jake projected on the screen an enlarged version of the letter to him from Seth. He also handed a copy to each juror. Judge Attlee said, "Now, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to pause for a moment while each of you carefully reads this letter." The courtroom was instantly silent as the jurors read their copies and the spectators studied the screen. "Herein you will find my last will and testament, every word written by me and signed and dated by me. I've checked the law of Mississippi and am satisfied that it is a proper holographic will, thus entitled to full enforcement under the law. No one witnessed me signing this will because, as you know, witnesses are not required for holographic wills. A year ago, I signed a thicker version in the offices of the Rush Law Firm in Tupelo, but I have renounced that document. This one is likely to start some trouble, and that's why I want you as the attorney for my estate. I want this will defended at all costs, and I know you can do it. I specifically cut out my two adult children, their children, and my two ex-wives. These are not nice people, and they will fight, so get ready. My estate is substantial. They have no idea of its size, and when this is made known, they will attack. Fight them, Mr. Brigance, to the bitter end. We must prevail. With my suicide note, I left instructions for my funeral and burial. Do not mention my last will and testament until after the funeral. I want my family to be forced to go through all the rituals of mourning before they realize they get nothing. Watch them fake it. They're very good at it. They have no love for me. I thank you in advance for your zealous representation. It will not be easy. I am comforted in knowing I will not be there to suffer through such an agonizing ordeal. Sincerely, Seth Hubbard. October 1st, 1988. Slowly, as each juror finished, they could not help but glance into the audience and take a look at Herschel Hubbard and Ramona Defoe. She wanted to cry, but at that moment she correctly assumed anyone looking would think she was only faking it. So she stared at the floor, along with her brother and husband, and waited for this awkward and awful time to pass. Finally, after an eternity, Judge Attlee said, "Let's take a 15-minute recess." In spite of Seth's warnings about the hazards of smoking, at least half of the jurors needed a cigarette. The non-smokers stayed in the jury room and had coffee, while the rest followed a bailiff to a small patio overlooking the north side of the courthouse lawn. They quickly fired up and began puffing away. Nevin Dark was trying to quit and had whittled his habit down to half a pack a day, but at the moment he was craving nicotine. Jim Whitehurst eased beside him, took a puff, and said, "What do you think, Mr. Foreman?" Judge Attlee had been explicit in his warnings. Do not discuss this case. But jurors in every trial couldn't wait to discuss what they had just seen and heard. Almost under his breath, Nevin said, "Looks like the old boy knew exactly what he was doing. You?" "No doubt about it," whispered Jim. Just above them, in the county law library, Jake gathered with Portia, Letty, Quince Lundy, and Harry Rex. And there was no shortage of observations and opinions. Portia was unnerved because Frank Doley, number 12, kept staring at her, frowning with his lips moving as if he were cursing. Letty thought Debbie Lacker, number 10, had fallen asleep, while Harry Rex was certain number 2, Tracy McMillan, had already developed a crush on Jake. Quince Lundy still maintained the jury was already split, but Harry Rex said they'd be lucky to get 4 votes. Jake politely asked him to shut up and reminded him of his dire predictions during the trial of Carl Lee Haley. After 10 minutes of mindless chatter, Jake vowed to eat lunch alone. Back in the courtroom, he called Quince Lundy to the stand and led him through a series of bland but necessary questions about his involvement in the estate, his appointment as the administrator, and his substitution for Russell Amberg, who wanted out. Lundy dryly explained the duties of the administrator and did a superb job of making it sound as dull as it really was. Jake handed him the original handwritten will and asked him to identify it. Lundy said, "This is the holographic will that was admitted to probate on October 4th of last year, signed by Mr. Seth Hubbard on the first day of October." "Let's have a look," Jake said, and once again projected the document onto the screen as he passed out copies to the jurors. Judge Atlee said, "Again, ladies and gentlemen, take your time and read it carefully. You will be allowed to take all documents and exhibits back to the jury room when you begin your deliberations." Jake stood by the podium, held a copy of the will, and pretended to read it as he carefully watched the jurors. Most seemed to frown at one point or another, and he assumed the "perish in pain" phrase made them cringe. He had read the will 100 times and still had the same 2 reactions. One, it was mean-spirited, harsh, cruel, and unreasonable. 2, it made him wonder what Letty was doing to make the old boy so fond of her. But as always, another reading convinced him Seth knew precisely what he was doing. If a person has testamentary capacity, then that person can make all the wild and unreasonable bequests he or she wants. When the last juror finished and laid down her copy, Jake turned off the overhead projector. He and Quince Lundy then spent 30 minutes hitting the highlights of Seth Hubbard's amazing 10-year journey from the ruins of his second divorce to wealth that no one in Ford County had ever seen. At 12:30, Judge Atlee recessed until 2 p.m. Chapter 42. The detective was leaving the hospital as Lucian was entering it. They spoke briefly in the main lobby, just a few words about Lonnie Clark, still up there on the 3rd floor and not doing well. He had had a rough night and his doctors said no visitors. Lucian got lost in the hospital and surfaced on the 3rd floor an hour later. There was no cop by the door, no nurses tending to Lonnie. Lucian sneaked into the room, gently shook Ansel's arm, and said, "Ansel, Ansel, are you there?" But Ansel wasn't there. Within the tiny Brigance firm, there was a general agreement that the morning could not have gone better. The presentation of the suicide note, funeral and burial instructions, handwritten will, and the letter to Jake made it perfectly clear that Seth Hubbard planned everything and was in control until the very end. Jake's opening statement had been persuasive. Lanier's, though, was just as masterful. All in all, a good beginning. Jake began the afternoon session by calling to the stand the Reverend Don McElwain, pastor of Irish Road Christian Church. The preacher told the jury he had spoken briefly to Seth after the worship hour on October 2nd, a few hours before he hung himself. He knew Seth was gravely ill, though he did not know the doctors had given him only weeks to live. On that morning, Seth seemed to be in good spirits, alert, even smiling, and told McIlwain how much he enjoyed the sermon. Though he was sick and frail, he did not appear to be drugged or under the influence. He had been a member of the church for 20 years and usually showed up about once a month. 3 weeks before he died, Seth had purchased for $350 a plot in the cemetery, the same plot he now occupied. The church's treasurer was next. Mr. Willis Stubbs testified that Seth dropped into the offering plate a check in the amount of $500 dated October 2nd. For the year, Seth contributed $2,600. Mr. Everett Walker took the stand and shared a private moment in what was likely Seth's last conversation. As the two walked to the parking lot after church, Mr. Walker asked how business was going. Seth made a crack about a slow hurricane season. More hurricanes meant more property damage and demand for lumber. Seth claimed to love hurricanes. According to Mr. Walker, his friend was sharp, witty, and did not seem to be in pain. Of course, he was frail. When Mr. Walker later heard that Seth was dead and that he had killed himself not long after their conversation, he was stunned. The man seemed so at ease and relaxed, even content. He had known Seth for many years, and he was not the slightest bit gregarious. Rather, Seth was a quiet man who kept to himself and said little. He remembered Seth smiling as he drove away that Sunday and remarked to his wife that it was rare to see him smile. Mrs. Gilda Chatham told the jury she and her husband sat behind Seth during his final sermon, spoke to him briefly when the service was over, and picked up no clue whatsoever that he was on the verge of such a startling act. Mrs. Nettie Vinson testified that she said hello to Seth as they were leaving the church and that he seemed uncharacteristically friendly. After a short recess, Seth's oncologist, a Dr. Talbert from the Regional Medical Center in Tupelo, was sworn in and quickly managed to bore the courtroom with a long and dry narrative about his patient's lung cancer. He had treated Seth for almost a year, and referring to his notes, went on and on about the surgery, then the chemotherapy and radiation and medications. There had been little hope initially, but Seth had fought hard. When the cancer metastasized to his spine and ribs, they knew the end was near. Dr. Talbert had seen Seth 2 weeks before he died and was surprised at how determined he was to keep going. But the pain was intense. He increased the oral dosage of Demerol to 100 milligrams every 3 to 4 hours. Seth preferred not to take the Demerol because the drug often made him drowsy. In fact, he said more than once that he tried to survive each day without pain meds. Dr. Talbert did not know how many tablets Seth actually took. In the past 2 months, he had prescribed 200. Jake's purpose in putting the doctor on the stand was twofold. First, he wanted to establish the fact that Seth was almost dead from lung cancer. Therefore, hopefully, the act of suicide might not seem so drastic and unreasonable. Jake planned to argue later that Seth was indeed thinking clearly in his last days, regardless of how he chose to die. The pain was unbearable. The end was near. He simply sped things along. Second, Jake wanted to confront head-on the issue of the side effects of Demerol. Lanier had some heavyweight testimony lined up, an expert who would say the powerful narcotic taken in the quantities prescribed seriously impaired Seth's judgment. An odd fact in the case was that the last prescription was never found. Seth had purchased it at a pharmacy in Tupelo 6 days before he died. Then he apparently disposed of it. Thus, there was no proof of how much or how little he had actually consumed. At his specific instructions, he was buried without an autopsy. Months earlier, Wade Lanier had suggested, off the record, that the body be exhumed for toxicity tests. Judge Attlee said no, again, off the record. The level of opiates in Seth's blood on Sunday when he died was not automatically relevant to the level the day before when he wrote his will. Judge Attlee seemed to be particularly offended by the notion of digging up a person after he had been properly laid to rest. Jake was pleased with his direct examination of Dr. Talbert. They clearly established that Seth tried to avoid taking Demerol, and that there was simply no way to prove how much was in his system when he made his last will. Wade Lanier managed to get the doctor to admit that a patient taking up to 6 to 8 doses a day of Demerol at 100 milligrams each should not consider making important decisions, especially ones dealing with large sums of money. Such a patient should be somewhere resting comfortably and quietly. No driving, no physical activity, no crucial decision-making. After the doctor was excused, Jake called Arlene Trotter, Seth's longtime secretary and office manager. She would be his last witness before Letty, and since they were approaching 5 p.m., Jake made the decision to save Letty for early Wednesday morning. He had spoken to Arlene many times since Seth's death and was nervous about putting her on the stand. He really had no choice. If he didn't call her, Wade Lanier certainly would. She had been deposed in early February and had been evasive, in Jake's opinion. After 4 hours, he strongly believed she had been coached by Lanier or someone working for him. Nonetheless, she spent more time with Seth the last week of his life than anyone else, and her testimony was crucial. She appeared terrified as she swore to tell the truth and settled into the seat. She glanced at the jurors, who were watching closely. Jake asked the preliminary questions, the ones with easy and obvious answers, and she seemed to settle down. He established that from Monday through Friday of the week before he died, Seth arrived at his office each morning around 9, which was later than usual. He was generally upbeat and in good spirits until noon, when he took a long nap on the sofa in his office. He wasn't eating, though Arlene kept offering snacks and sandwiches. He kept smoking. He was never able to stop. As always, he kept his door closed, so Arlene wasn't exactly sure what he was doing. However, he stayed busy that week trying to sell 3 tracts of timberland in South Carolina. He was on the phone a lot, which was not unusual. At least once an hour, he left the building and went for a stroll around the premises. He stopped and talked to some of his employees. He flirted with Kamala, the girl at the front desk. Arlene knew he was in great pain because at times he couldn't hide it, though he never ever admitted this. He let it slip once that he was taking Demerol, though she never saw the bottle of pills. No, he was not glassy-eyed. He did not slur his speech. At times he was fatigued, and he napped often. Usually he left around 3 or 4. Jake was able to paint the picture of a man still in charge, the boss at work, as if all was well. For 5 consecutive days before he wrote a new will, Seth Hubbard was at the office, on the phone, tending to his business. Wade Lanier began his cross-examination with,
"Let's talk about this timberland in South Carolina, Miss Trotter. Did Seth Hubbard sell these 3 tracts of land?"
"Yes, sir, he did."
"And when?"
"On that Friday morning."
"The Friday morning before he wrote his will on Saturday, correct?"
"Correct."
"Did he sign any sort of contract?"
He did. It was faxed to my desk, and I took it to him. He signed it, and I faxed it back to the attorneys in Spartanburg.
Lanier picked up a document and said,
Your Honor, I have here Exhibit C-5, which has already been stipulated to and admitted.
Judge Attlee said,
Proceed.
Lanier handed the document to Arlene and said,
Could you please identify that?
Yes, sir. It's the contract Seth signed on Friday morning, selling the 3 tracts of land in South Carolina.
And how much was Seth to receive?
A total of $810,000.
$810,000. Now, Miss Trotter, how much did Seth pay for this timberland?
She paused for a moment, glanced nervously at the jurors, and said,
You have the paperwork, Mr. Lanier.
Of course.
Lanier produced 3 more exhibits, all of which had been marked and admitted beforehand. There were no surprises here. Jake and Lanier had haggled over the exhibits and documents for weeks. Judge Attlee had long since ruled them admissible. Arlene slowly reviewed the exhibits as the courtroom waited. Finally, she said,
Mr. Hubbard purchased this land in 1985 and paid a total of $1.1 million.
Lanier scribbled this down as if it were new. Peering over his reading glasses with his eyebrows arched in disbelief, he said,
A loss of $300,000.
Apparently so.
And this was only 24 hours before he made his handwritten will.
Jake was on his feet.
Objection, Your Honor. Cause for speculation on the part of the witness. Counsel can save it for his closing argument. Sustained.
Lanier ignored the commotion and zeroed in on the witness.
Any idea, Ms. Trotter, why Seth would do such a bad deal?
Jake rose again.
Objection, Your Honor. More speculation.
Sustained.
Was he thinking clearly, Miss Trotter? Objection!
Sustained. Lanier paused and flipped a page of notes.
Now, Miss Trotter, who was in charge of cleaning the office building where you and Seth worked?
A man named Monk.
Okay. Tell us about Monk.
He's a longtime employee at the lumberyard, sort of a general helper who does all sorts of odd jobs. Mainly cleaning. He also paints, fixes everything, even wash Mr. Hubbard's vehicles.
How often does Monk clean the offices?
Every Monday and Thursday morning, from 9 until 11, without fail, for many years now.
Did he clean the offices on Thursday, September 29th of last year?
He did.
Has Letty Lang ever cleaned the offices?
Not to my knowledge. There was no need for her to do so. Monk was in charge of that. I've never seen Ms. Lang until today.
Throughout the day, Myron Pankey moved around the courtroom. His job was to watch the jury constantly, but to do so without being obvious required a number of tricks. Different seats, different vantage points, a change in sports coats, shielding his face behind a larger person sitting in front of him, the use of various eyeglasses. He spent his career in courtrooms, listening to witnesses and watching jurors react to them. In his learned opinion, Jake had done a steady job of laying out his case. Nothing fancy, nothing memorable, but no blunders either. The majority of the jurors liked him and believed that he was searching for the truth. 3 apparently did not. Frank Doley, number 12, was firmly in their corner and would never vote to give all that money to a black housekeeper. Pankey did not know the tragic story of Doley's niece, but he could tell from the opening statements the man distrusted Jake and did not like Letty. Number 10, Debbie Lacker, a 50-year-old white woman and quite rural, had shot several hard looks at Letty throughout the day, little messages that Myron never missed. Number 4, Faye Pollen, another 50-year-old white woman, had actually nodded in agreement when Dr. Talbert testified that a person on Demerol should not make important decisions. As the first day of testimony came to a close, Pankey called it a draw. Two fine lawyers had performed well, and the jurors had not missed a word. With Ansel unable to talk, Lucian spent the day in a rented car touring glaciers and fjords in the mountains around Juneau. He was tempted to leave, to hustle back to Clanton for the trial, but he was also quite taken with the beauty of Alaska and the cool air and near-perfect climate. It was already heating up in Mississippi, with longer days and stickier air. As he ate lunch at a hillside café, the Gastineau Channel stretched magnificently below him. He made the decision to leave tomorrow, Wednesday. At some point, and soon, Jake would inform Judge Antley that Ansel Hubbard had been located and verified, though the verification was shaky, because the subject might change his mind at any moment and adopt another alias. Lucian doubted this, though, because Ansel was thinking about the money. Such a revelation would not affect the trial. Wade Lanier was right. Ansel had nothing to say about his brother's will or testamentary capacity, so Lucian would leave him to his own problems. He suspected Ansel might serve a few months in prison. If he got lucky and found a good lawyer, he might walk entirely. Lucian was convinced the search and seizure of the cocaine was a clear violation of the Fourth Amendment. Suppress the search, eliminate the cocaine, and Ansel would be free again. If Jake won the trial, Ansel might one day make his long-deferred return to Ford County and claim his share of the estate. If Jake lost, Ansel would disappear into the night, never to be found again. After dark, Lucian went to the hotel bar and said good evening to Bo Buck, the bartender, who was now a close friend. Bo Buck had once been a judge in Nevada before things conspired to wreck his life, and he and Lucian enjoyed swapping stories. They talked for a moment as Lucian waited on his first Jack and Coke. He took it to a table and sat down, alone and loving the solitude. Just a man and his sour mash. A minute later, Ansel Hubbard materialized from nowhere and sat across the table. "Evening, Lucian," he said casually. Startled, Lucian stared at him for a few seconds to make sure. He was wearing a baseball cap, a sweatshirt, and jeans. That morning, he had been unconscious in a hospital bed with tubes running everywhere.
"Didn't expect to see you here," Lucian said.
"I got tired of the hospital, so I walked out. I guess I'm a fugitive, but that's nothing new. I kind of like being on the run."
"What about your head and the infection?"
"My head's sore, though not nearly as sore as they thought. Remember, Lucian, I was scheduled to go from the hospital to the jail, a transfer I preferred not to make. Let's just say I wasn't nearly as unconscious as they thought. The infection is under control." He pulled out a bottle of pills. "When I left, I took my antibiotics. I'll be all right."
"How'd you leave?"
"Walked out. They rolled me downstairs for a scan. I went to the restroom. They thought I couldn't walk, so I ran down some steps, found the basement, found the locker room, changed clothes, came out through the service ramp. Cops were swarming last time I checked. I was drinking coffee across the street."
"This is a small town, Ansel. You can't hide for long."
"What do you know about hiding?"
"I have some friends." "You want something to drink?"
"No, but I'd love a burger and fries." Harry Rex scowled at the witness and demanded, "Did you touch his penis?" Letty looked away embarrassed, then managed a tepid,
"Yes. Yes, I did."
"Of course you did, Letty," Jake said,
He was unable to bathe himself, so you had to do it. And you did it more than once. A bath means bathing the entire body. He couldn't do it. You had to. There was nothing intimate or even remotely sexual about it. You were simply doing your job.
I can't do this, Letty said, looking helplessly at Portia. He won't ask me these questions, will he?
He damn sure will, Harry Rex growled. He'll ask you these and many more, and you'd better be ready with the answers.
Let's take a break, Jake said.
I need a beer, Harry Rex said, climbing to his feet. He stomped out of the room as if he were sick of them all. They had been rehearsing for 2 hours, and it was almost 10 p.m.
Jake asked the easy questions on direct examination, and Harry Rex grilled her relentlessly on cross. At times, he was too rough, or rougher than Attlee would allow Lanier to be, but better to be ready for the worst. Portia sympathized with her mother, but she was also frustrated by her fragility. Letty could be tough, then she would fall apart. There was no confidence that her testimony would go smoothly. Remember the rules, Letty, Jake kept saying. Smile, but nothing phony. Speak clearly and slowly. It's okay to cry if you feel real emotion. If you're not sure, don't speak. The jurors are watching intently, and they miss nothing. Look at them occasionally, but with confidence. Don't let Wade Lanier rattle you. I'll always be there to protect you. Harry Rex wanted to scream another piece of advice.
We're talking about $24 million here, so put on the performance of a lifetime.
But he controlled himself. When he returned with the beer, Portia said,
We've had enough, Jake. We'll go home and sit on the porch and talk some more. And we'll be here early in the morning.
Okay. I think we're all tired.
After they left, Jake and Harry Rex went upstairs and sat on Jake's balcony. The night was warm but clear, a perfect spring night that was difficult to appreciate. Jake sipped a beer and relaxed for the first time in many hours.
Any word from Lucian? Harry Rex asked.
No, but I forgot to check the phone messages.
We're lucky, you know. Lucky he's in Alaska and not sitting right here carping about everything that went wrong today.
That's your job, right?
Right. But I got no complaints, so far. You had a good day, Jake. You made a good opening statement, one the jury heard and appreciated. Then you called 12 witnesses, and not a one got burned. The evidence leans strongly in your favor, at least at this point. You couldn't have asked for a better day.
And the jury?
They like you, but it's too early to speculate on how much they like or dislike Letty. Tomorrow will be revealing.
Tomorrow is crucial, buddy. Letty can win the case, or she can lose it.
Chapter 43. The lawyers met with Judge Attlee in his chambers at 8:45 Wednesday morning and agreed there were no pending motions or issues to iron out before the trial proceeded. For the third day in a row, His Honor was spry, almost hyper, as if the excitement of a big trial had rejuvenated him. The lawyers had been up all night, either working or worrying, and looked as frayed as they felt. The old judge, though, was ready to go. In the courtroom, he welcomed everyone, thanked the spectators for their keen interest in our judicial system, and told the bailiff to bring in the jurors. When they were seated, he greeted them warmly and asked if there were any problems, any unauthorized contact, anything suspicious, everyone feeling okay. Very well, Mr. Brigance, proceed. Jake stood and said,
Your Honor, the proponents call Ms. Letty Lang.
Portia had told her not to wear anything fitting or tight or even remotely sexy. Early that morning, long before breakfast, they had argued about the dress. Portia won. It was a navy blue cotton dress with a loose belt, a nice enough dress, but one that a housekeeper might wear to work, nothing Letty would wear to church. The shoes were low-heeled sandals, no jewelry, no watch, nothing to indicate she had a spare dime or might be contemplating a haul of cash. In the past month, she had stopped tinting her gray hair. It was natural now, and she looked all of her 47 years. She was practically stuttering by the time she swore to tell the truth. She looked at Portia sitting behind Jake's chair. Her daughter gave her a smile, a signal that she should smile too. The packed courtroom was silent as Jake approached the podium. He asked her name, address, place of employment, softballs that she handled well, names of children and grandchildren. Yes, Marvis, her oldest, was in prison. Her husband was Simeon Lang, now in jail, awaiting prosecution. She had filed for divorce a month earlier and expected it to become final in a few weeks. Some background, education, church, prior jobs. It was all scripted, and at times her answers sounded stiff and rote, even memorized, which they were. She glanced at the jurors, but was rattled when she realized they were staring right back. As her handlers had discussed, when she felt nervous, she was to look directly at Portia. At times, she couldn't take her eyes off her daughter. Jake eventually made it to the subject of Mr. Seth Hubbard, or simply Mr. Hubbard, as she was to always call him in court. Never Seth, never Mr. Seth. Mr. Hubbard hired her as a part-time housekeeper 3 years earlier. How did she hear about the job opening? She did not. He called her and said a friend knew she was out of work. He happened to be looking for a part-time maid. She went through her history with Mr. Hubbard, his rules, habits, routines, and later his preferences in food and cooking. 3 days a week became four. He gave her a raise, then another. He traveled a lot, and she was often in the house with little to do. Not once in 3 years did he entertain or have another person over for a meal. She met Herschel and Ramona, but rarely saw them. Ramona visited once a year, and for only a few hours, and Herschel's drop-ins were not much more frequent. She had never met any of Mr. Hubbard's four grandchildren.
"But I didn't work on the weekends, so I don't know who came and went then," she said. "Mr. Hubbard could have had all sorts of company."
She was trying to appear fair, but only to a point. "But you worked every Monday, correct?" Jake asked from the script.
"I did."
"And did you ever see evidence of weekend guests in the home?"
"No, sir, never."
Being nice to Herschel and Ramona was not part of the plan at this point. They had no plans to be nice to Letty. Indeed, based on their depositions, it was safe to expect them to lie considerably. After an hour on the stand, Letty felt more comfortable. Her answers were clearer, more spontaneous, and she occasionally smiled at the jurors. Jake eventually got around to Mr. Hubbard's lung cancer. She described how her boss went through a string of unimpressive home health care nurses and finally asked Letty if she would work 5 days a week. She described the low points, when the chemo knocked him flat and almost killed him, when he couldn't walk to the bathroom or feed himself. "Do not show emotion," Portia had lectured. "Do not show any feelings whatsoever for Mr. Hubbard." The jurors cannot get the impression there was an emotional bond between the two of you. Of course there had been, the same as any dying person and his caregiver. But do not acknowledge it on the witness stand. Jake hit the high points, but did not spend much time on Mr. Hubbard's cancer. Wade Lanier would certainly do so. Jake asked Letty if she had ever signed a will. No, she had not.
Have you ever seen a will?
No, sir.
Did Mr. Hubbard ever discuss his will with you?
She managed to chuckle and sold it perfectly. She said,
Mr. Hubbard was extremely private. He never discussed business or anything like that with me. He never discussed his family or kids or anything. He just wasn't like that.
The truth was that Seth had twice promised Letty he would leave something behind for her, but he had never mentioned his will. She and Portia had discussed it, and it was Portia's opinion that Wade Lanier and the lawyers on the other side would blow this out of proportion if she admitted it. They would twist it, exaggerate it, and turn it into something lethal.
So you did discuss his last will with him, Lanier would yell in front of the jury.
Some things are better left unsaid. No one would ever know. Seth was dead, and Letty wasn't talking.
Did he ever discuss his illness and the fact that he was dying? Jake asked.
She took a deep breath and pondered the question.
Sure. There was times when he was in so much pain, he said he wanted to die. I suppose that's natural. In his last days, Mr. Hubbard knew the end was near. He asked me to pray with him.
You prayed with him?
I did. Mr. Hubbard had a deep faith in God. He wanted to make things right before he died.
Jake paused for a little drama, so the jurors could fully absorb the visual of Letty and her boss praying instead of doing what most folks thought they had been doing. Then he moved on to the morning of October 1st of last year, and Letty told her story. They left his house around 9 o'clock, with Letty behind the wheel of his late model Cadillac. She had never driven him before. He had never asked her to. It was the first and only time the two had been together in an automobile. When they were leaving the house, she had made some silly comment about never having driven a Cadillac, so he insisted. She was nervous and drove slowly. He sipped on coffee from a paper cup. He seemed to be relaxed and pain-free, and he seemed to enjoy the fact that Letty was so uptight driving down a highway with virtually no other traffic. Jake asked her what they talked about during the 10-minute drive. She thought for a moment, glanced at the jurors, who still had not missed a word, and said,
"We talked about cars. He said a lot of white people don't like Cadillacs anymore because nowadays so many black people drive them. He asked me why a Cadillac was so important to a black person, and I said, don't ask me. I never wanted one. I'll never have one. My Pontiac's 12 years old. But then I said, it's because it's the nicest car, and it's a way of showing other folk that you made it. You got a job, got a little money in your pocket, got some success in life. Something's working okay. That's all. He said he always liked a Cadillac, too. Said he lost his first one in his first divorce. Lost his second one in his second divorce. But since he gave up on marriage, nobody's bothered him or his Cadillacs. He was kind of funny about it.
So he was in a good mood, sort of joking, Jake asked.
A very good mood that morning, yes, sir. He even laughed at me and my driving.
And his mind was clear?
Clear as a bell. He said I was driving his 7th Cadillac, and he remembered all of them. Said he trades every other year.
Do you know if he was taking medication for pain that morning?
No, sir, I don't know. He was funny about his pills. He didn't like to take them, and he kept them in his briefcase away from me. The only time I saw him was when he was flat on his back, deathly sick, and he asked me to get them. But no, he didn't appear to be on any pain medication that morning.
Under Jake's guidance, she continued her narrative. They arrived at Bering Lumber Company, the first and only time she had ever been there, and while he spent the time in his office with the door locked, she cleaned. She vacuumed, dusted, scrubbed most of the windows, arranged magazines, even washed the dishes in the small kitchen. No, she did not empty the waste baskets. From the moment they entered the offices until they left, she did not speak to nor see Mr. Hubbard. She had no idea what he was doing in his office. She never thought about asking. He walked in with a briefcase and walked out holding the same one. She drove back to his house, then she returned home around noon. Late Sunday night, Calvin Boggs called with the news that Mr. Hubbard had hung himself. At 11 a.m., after almost 2 hours on the stand, Jake tendered the witness for cross-examination. During a quick recess, he told Letty she did a fabulous job. Portia was thrilled and very proud. Her mother had kept her composure and been convincing. Harry Rex, who had been watching from the back row, said her testimony could not have been better. By noon, their case was in shambles. He was certain harboring a fugitive was against the law in every state, including Alaska, so jail time was a possibility, though Lucian wasn't worried about that at the moment. He woke up at sunrise, stiff from sleeping off and on in a chair. Ansel had the bed, all of it. He had volunteered to sleep on the floor, or in a chair, but Lucian was concerned about his head injuries and insisted he take the bed. A painkiller knocked him out, and for a long time Lucian sat in the dark, nursing his last Jack and Coke, listening to the old boy snore. He dressed quietly and left the room. The lobby of the hotel was deserted. There were no cops poking around, searching for Ansel. Down the street, he bought coffee and muffins and hauled them back to the room, where Ansel was awake now and watching the local news. "Not a word," he reported. "No surprise," Lucian said. "I doubt if they've brought in the bloodhounds." They ate, took turns showering and dressing, and at 8 a.m. left the room. Ansel was wearing Lucian's black suit, white shirt, paisley tie, and the same cap pulled low to hide his face. They hurriedly walked 3 blocks to the law office of Jared Walkowitz, a lawyer referred by Beau Buck at the Glacier Inn bar. Lucian had visited Mr. Walkowitz late the day before, retained him, and organized the deposition. A court reporter and a videographer were waiting in the conference room. At one end of the table, Mr. Walkowitz stood, raised his right hand, repeated after the court reporter, and swore to tell the truth, then sat facing the camera. He said, "Good morning. My name is Jared Walkowitz, and I'm an attorney, duly licensed by the state of Alaska. Today is Wednesday, April 5th, 1989, and I'm sitting here in my law office on Franklin Street in downtown Juneau, Alaska. Here with me is Lucian Wilbanks of Clanton, Mississippi, and also a man by the name of Ansel F. Hubbard, who currently resides in Juneau. The purpose of the deposition is to record the testimony of Mr. Hubbard. I know nothing about the case that brings us here. My role is to simply vouch for the fact that this will be an accurate recording of what takes place here. If any of the lawyers or judges involved in this matter would like to speak to me, feel free to call." Walkowitz left the chair, and Lucian stepped forward. He was sworn by the court reporter, then likewise sat facing the camera. He said, "My name is Lucian Wilbanks, and I'm well known to Judge Attlee and the lawyers involved in the contest over the last will and testament of Seth Hubbard. Working with Jake Brigance and others, I have been able to locate Ansel Hubbard. I have spent several hours with Ansel, and there is no doubt in my mind that he is in fact the surviving brother of Seth Hubbard. He was born in Ford County in 1922. His father was Cleon Hubbard.
His mother was Sarah Bell Hubbard. In 1928, his father, Cleon, hired my grandfather, Robert E. Lee Wilbanks, to represent him in a land dispute. That dispute is relevant today. Here is Ansel Hubbard.
Lucian vacated the chair, and Ansel took it. He raised his right hand and swore to tell the truth. Wade Lanier began his toxic cross-examination by asking about Simeon. Why was he in jail? Had he been indicted? How often had she visited him? Was he contesting the divorce? It was a harsh but effective way to remind the jurors that the father of Letty's five children was a drunk who had killed the Ruston boys. After 5 minutes, Letty was wiping tears, and Lanier looked like a prick. He didn't care. With her emotions in play and her judgment temporarily impaired, he quickly switched gears and laid his trap.
"Now, Ms. Lang, prior to being employed by Mr. Hubbard, where did you work?"
Letty wiped a cheek with the back of a hand and tried to collect her thoughts.
That was Mr. and Mrs. Tingley here in Clanton.
What type of work?
Housekeeper.
How long did you work for them?
I don't know exactly, but about 3 years.
And why did you leave their employment?
They died, both of them.
Did they leave you any money in their wills?
If they did, nobody ever told me.
This got a few smiles from the jurors. Wade Lanier missed the humor. He continued,
"And before the Tingleys, where did you work?"
Before that, I worked as a cook in a school in Caraway.
For how long?
Maybe 2 years.
And why did you leave there?
I got the job with the Tingleys, and I'd rather work as a housekeeper than a cook.
Okay. Before the job at the school, where did you work?
She was silent as she tried to remember. Finally, she said,
"Before the school, I worked for Mrs. Gillenwater here in Clanton as a housekeeper."
And for how long?
About a year. Then she moved away.
Before Mrs. Gillenwater, where did you work?
That would be the Glovers in Caraway.
And for how long?
Again, I can't remember exactly, but it was 3 or 4 years.
Okay. I'm not trying to nail down specifics, Ms. Lang. Just remember things as best you can, all right?
Yes, sir.
And before the Glovers, where did you work?
That was Miss Carston, here in town. I worked for her 6 years. She was my favorite. I never wanted to leave her, but she died suddenly.
Thank you.
Lanier scribbled on his legal pad as if he was learning something new.
Now, just to summarize, Ms. Lang, you worked for Mr. Hubbard for 3 years. The Tingleys, 3, the school, 2, Mrs. Gillenwater, 1, the Glovers, 3 or 4, and 6 years for Miss Carston. According to my math, that's approximately 20 years. Does that sound about right?
It does. Give or take a year here, a year there,
Letty said confidently.
And you've had no other employers in the past 20 or so years?
She shook her head no. Lanier was going somewhere, but Jake couldn't stop him. The inflections of his voice, the slight hints of suspicion, the arched eyebrows, the matter-of-factness of his sentences. He was trying to disguise all these, but to Jake's trained ears and eyes, they meant trouble.
That's 6 employers in 20 years, Ms. Lang. How many times were you fired?
None. I mean, I was terminated after Mr. Hubbard died, and Miss Carston got sick,
and Mr. and Mrs. Tingley passed, but that was just because the job sort of played out, you know.
You've never been fired for doing a bad job or for doing something wrong.
No, sir, never.
Lanier abruptly backed away from the podium, looked up at Judge Attlee, and said,
"That's all, Judge. I reserve the right to recall this witness later in the trial."
He walked smugly to his table, and at the last second, Jake saw him wink at Lester Chilcott. Letty had just lied, and Lanier was about to expose her. Jake, though, had no idea what was coming. Thus, he had no way to prevent it. His instincts were to get her off the witness stand. He stood and said, "Your Honor, the proponents rest." Judge Attlee said, "Do you have some witnesses, Mr. Lanier?"
"Oh, yes."
"Then call the first one."
"The contestants call Mr. Fritz Pickering."
"Who?"
Jake blurted.
"Fritz Pickering,"
Lanier repeated loudly and sarcastically, as if Jake were hard of hearing.
"Never heard of him. He's not on your witness list."
"He's out in the rotunda," Lanier said to a bailiff, "waiting."
Jake was shaking his head at Judge Attlee and said, "He can't testify if he's not listed as a witness, Judge."
"I'm calling him anyway," Lanier said.
Fritz Pickering entered the courtroom and followed a bailiff to the witness stand.
"I object, Your Honor," Jake said.
Judge Attlee removed his reading glasses, glared at Wade Lanier, and said,
"All right, let's take a 15-minute recess. I'll see the lawyers in chambers. Lawyers only, no paralegals or staff."
The jury was hurried out of the courtroom as the lawyers followed the judge into the rear hallway and into his cramped chambers. He did not remove his robe, but sat down and looked as confused as Jake.
"Start talking," he said to Lanier.
"Your Honor, this witness is not an evidentiary witness. Thus, he does not have to be made known to the other side. His purpose is to impeach the credibility of another witness, not to give evidence. I was not required to put him on the list or in any way divulge his name because I was never certain he would be called. Now, based on the testimony of Letty Lang and her inability to tell the truth, this witness is suddenly crucial to our case."
Judge Attlee exhaled as every lawyer in the room racked his brain for bits and pieces of the rules of evidence and the rules of civil procedure. At the moment, there was little doubt Lanier had full command of the rules regarding witness impeachment. This was his ambush, one he and Lester Chilcott had planned perfectly. Jake wanted to gush forth in some cogent and sensible argument, but brilliance failed him miserably at the moment.
"What will the witness say?" Judge Attlee asked.
"Letty Lang once worked for his mother, Mrs. Irene Pickering. Fritz and his sister fired Letty when his sister found a handwritten will leaving $50,000 in cash to Letty. She just told at least three lies. Number one, she said she had worked for only those people I mentioned over the past 20 or so years. Mrs. Pickering hired her in 1978, and they fired her in 1980. Number two, she has in fact been fired as a housekeeper. Number three, she said she has never seen a will. Fritz and his sister showed her the handwritten will the day they fired her. There may be another one or two. I can't think of them all right now."
Jake's shoulders fell as his gut clenched, his vision blurred, and the color drained from his face. It was imperative that he say something intelligent, but everything was blank. Then lightning struck, and he asked,
"When did you find Fritz Pickering?"
I didn't meet him until today, Lanier said smugly.
That's not what I asked. When did you find out about the Pickerings?
During discovery. Again, Jake, it's another example of us outworking you. We found more witnesses. We've been out there beating the bushes, working our asses off. I don't know what you've been doing.
And the rules require you to submit the names of your witnesses. 2 weeks ago, you dumped the names of 45 new ones on the table. You're not playing by the rules here, Wade. Judge, this is a clear violation of the rules. Judge Attlee raised a hand and said, Enough. Allow me to think a moment. He stood, walked to his desk, took one of a dozen pipes from a rack, stuffed it with Sir Walter Raleigh, lit up, blew a thick cloud of smoke toward the ceiling, and drifted away. On one side of the table, Wade Lanier, Lester Chilcott, Zach Zeitler, and Joe Bradley Hunt sat smugly, silently, waiting for a decision that would send the trial either north or south with no return. On the other side, Jake sat alone, scribbling notes that not even he could decipher. He felt ill and couldn't make his hands stop shaking. Wade Lanier had pulled a masterful dirty trick, and it was infuriating. At the same time, Jake wanted to grab Letty and lash out at her. Why had she not mentioned the Pickering matter? They had spent countless hours together since October. His Honor blew more smoke and said,
This is too crucial to keep out. I'll allow Mr. Pickering to testify, but within limits.
Angrily, Jake said,
Trial by ambush.
This will be automatically reversible. We'll be back in 2 years to do this all over again. Angrily, Judge Attlee barked,
Don't lecture, Jake. I've never been reversed by the Supreme Court. Never.
Jake took a deep breath and said,
Sorry.
Ansel's narrative ran for 58 minutes. When he finished, he wiped moisture from his eyes, said he was exhausted and couldn't continue, and left the room. Lucian thanked Jared Wolkowitz for his accommodations. He had not told the lawyer that Ansel was a man on the run. Walking back to the hotel, they saw several policemen loitering around a street corner and decided to duck into a coffee shop. They hid in a booth and tried to maintain small talk. Lucian was still rattled by the stories Ansel told, but neither was in the mood to pursue them. Lucian said,
I've paid for 2 more nights at the hotel. It's all yours. I'm leaving now. You can have the clothes, toothpaste, everything. There's a pair of old khakis hanging in a closet with $300 in the front pocket. It's yours.
Thanks, Lucian.
What are your plans?
I don't know. I really don't want to go to prison, so I'll probably skip town, as usual. Just disappear. These clowns can't catch me. This is pretty routine for me.
Where will you go?
Well, I might mosey on down to Mississippi, since my dear old brother thought so highly of me. When might I see some of his estate?
Who knows? They're fighting over it as we speak. Could be a month, could be 5 years. You have my phone number. Call me in a few weeks, and we'll catch up.
I'll do that.
Lucian paid for the coffee, and they left through a side door. In an alley, they said goodbye. Lucian was headed for the airport, Ansel the hotel. When he got there, the detective was waiting. In a crowded courtroom that was silent, even stunned, Fritz Pickering told his story, every devastating detail. Letty absorbed it in total defeat, her head bowed, her eyes on the floor. Then her eyes closed in agony. She shook her head from time to time as if she disagreed, but no one in the courtroom believed her. Lies, lies, lies. Fritz produced a copy of his mother's handwritten will. Jake objected to its admission into evidence on the grounds that there was no way to prove Irene Pickering's handwriting, but Judge Attlee barely heard him. It became evidence. Wade Lanier asked his witness to read the fourth paragraph, the one giving $50,000 to Letty Lang. He read it slowly and loudly. A couple of the jurors shook their heads in disbelief. Wade Lanier hammered away.
"So, Mr. Pickering, you and your sister sat Letty Lang down at the kitchen table and showed her the will handwritten by your mother, correct?"
"Correct."
"And if she testified earlier that she had never seen a will, then she was lying, correct?"
"I suppose."
"Objection," Jake said.
"Overruled,"
His Honor snarled from the bench. It was apparent, at least to Jake, that Judge Attlee was now the enemy. He viewed Letty as a liar, and in his world there was no greater sin. Over the years he had jailed several litigants when they were caught red-handed telling lies, but almost always in divorce cases. A night in jail worked wonders in the search for veracity. Letty was in no danger of going to jail. That would be far more preferable. At that dreadful moment, with the jurors squirming nervously and glancing around, she was in danger of losing about $20 million, give or take, before taxes, of course. When a witness is telling the truth, and the truth hurts, a trial lawyer has no alternative but to attack the witness's credibility. Jake sat stone-faced, as if he expected Fritz to say what he was saying. But just under the skin, he was desperately searching for a soft spot. What did Fritz have to gain by testifying? Why would he waste his time?
"Mr. Brigance," Judge Attlee said, when Lanier tendered the witness.
Jake stood quickly and faked as much confidence as possible. The first rule every trial lawyer learns is to never ask a question if you don't know the answer. But when you're staring at certain defeat, toss the rules. Shooting wildly from the hip, Jake said,
"Mr. Pickering, how much are you being paid to testify here today?"
The bullet landed between his eyes. He actually flinched as his jaw dropped, and he shot a desperate look at Wade Lanier. Lanier shrugged and nodded. "Go ahead. It's no big deal." Fritz said,
$7,500.
"And who's paying you?"
Jake demanded.
"The check came from Mr. Lanier's office."
"And what's the date on the check?"
"I don't remember exactly, but I got it about a month ago."
"So about a month ago, you guys closed the deal. You agreed to come here and testify, and Mr. Lanier sent you the money, right?"
"That's right."
"Didn't you, in fact, demand more than $7,500?"
Jake asked, still shooting wildly with no idea what the facts were. But he had a hunch.
"Well, yes, I did ask for more."
"You wanted at least $10,000, didn't you?"
"Something like that,"
Fritz admitted and looked at Lanier again. Jake was reading his mind.
"And you told Mr. Lanier that you would not testify unless you got paid, right?"
"At the time, I wasn't talking to Mr. Lanier. It was one of his investigators. I didn't meet Mr. Lanier until earlier this morning."
"Regardless, you were not going to testify for free, right?"
"That's right."
"When did you drive over from Shreveport?"
"Late yesterday afternoon."
"And when are you leaving Clanton?"
"Just as soon as I can."
"So, a quick trip, say 24 hours.
"Something like that."
$7,500 for 24 hours. You're an expensive witness."
"Is that a question?"
Jake was getting lucky, but he knew it couldn't last. He looked at his notes, chicken scratch he could not read, and changed course.
Mr. Pickering, didn't Letty Lang explain to you that she had nothing to do with the preparation of your mother's will? Jake had no idea what Letty had done. He had yet to discuss the incident with her. That would be an ugly conversation, probably during lunch.
That's what she said, Fritz replied.
And didn't she try to explain that your mother never said a word to her about the will?
That's what she said.
Where did you get this copy of the will?
I kept it.
Actually, it had arrived anonymously in the mail, but who would ever know the difference?
Nothing further, Jake said as he sat down. Judge Attlee announced,
"We'll be in recess until 1:30.
Chapter 44. Jake and Harry Rex fled town. With Jake driving, they raced deep into the countryside, putting distance between themselves and the nightmare in the courtroom. They wouldn't risk bumping into Letty or Portia or the other lawyers or anyone, for that matter, who had just witnessed the bloodletting. Harry Rex was the eternal contrarian. When a day in trial went smoothly, he could always be counted on to see nothing but negatives. A bad day? And he could be unbelievably optimistic about tomorrow. As Jake drove and seethed, he kept waiting for his foxhole buddy to pass along an observation that might lift his spirits, if only for a moment. What he got was,
"You'd better come off your high horse and settle this son of a bitch."
A mile passed before Jake responded.
"What makes you think Wade Lanier would talk settlement now? He just won the case. That jury wouldn't give Letty Lang $50 for a sack of groceries. You saw their faces.
You know the bad part, Jake."
"It's all bad. It's worse than bad."
"The bad part is that it makes you question everything about Letty. I've never thought for a moment that she manipulated Seth Hubbard into redoing his will. She's not that slick, and he wasn't that stupid. But now, all of a sudden, when you realize she's done it before, you say, okay, could this be a pattern? Could this old gal know more about will and estate law than we give her credit for? I don't know. It just rattles you.
And why would she cover it up?
Hell, I bet she's never told Portia, never told anyone about getting caught by the Pickerings. I guess I should have been smart enough to ask her 6 months ago. Say, Letty, have you talked anyone else into changing their wills and adding a nice provision for you? Why didn't you think of that?
Stupid, I guess. I feel pretty stupid right now."
Another mile passed, then another. Jake said,
"You're right. It makes you question everything. And if we feel this way, think about the jurors."
"The jurors are gone, Jake, and you'll never get them back. You've called your best witnesses, put on a near-perfect case, saved your star to go last, and she did a fine job. And then, in a matter of minutes, the case was totally destroyed by a surprise witness. You can forget this jury."
Another mile passed. Jake said,
"A surprise witness. Surely that's grounds for a reversal.
Don't bet on it. You can't let it get that far, Jake. You gotta settle this case before it goes to the jury."
"I'll have to resign as the attorney."
"Then so be it. You've made some money. Now get out of the way. Think about Letty for a moment."
"I'd rather not."
"I understand. But what if she walks out of that courtroom without a penny?"
"Maybe that's what she deserves."
They slid to a stop in the gravel parking lot of Bates Grocery. The red Saab was the only foreign car there. Every other vehicle was a pickup truck, and not a one less than 10 years old. They waited in line as Mrs. Bates patiently filled their plates with her vegetables, and Mr. Bates collected $3.50 from each customer,
sweet iced tea and cornbread included. The crowd was almost shoulder to shoulder, and there were no empty chairs.
"Over there,"
Mr. Bates said, nodding, and Jake and Harry Rex sat at a small counter not too far from the massive gas stove that was covered with pots. They could talk, but carefully. Not that it mattered. Not a single person having lunch knew a trial was underway in town, and they certainly didn't know how badly the trial had turned against Jake. Perched on a stool and hunched over his plate, he sat forlornly and looked through the crowd.
"Hey, you gotta eat,"
Harry Rex said.
"No appetite," Jake said.
"Can I have your plate?"
"Maybe. I envy these people. They don't have to go back into that courtroom."
"Neither do I. You on your own, buddy. You've screwed up the case so bad it can never be rescued. I'm out of there."
Jake pinched off a bite of cornbread and stuck it in his mouth. "Didn't you go to school with Lester Chilcott?"
"I did. Biggest prick in law school. Nice enough guy when we started. But then he got a job with a big Jackson firm, and bam, just like that, he became a flaming asshole. I guess it happens. He's not the first. Why?"
"Grab him this afternoon and whisper to him. See if they'll talk settlement."
"Okay. What kind of settlement?"
"I don't know. But if they'll come to the table, we'll cut a deal. If I resign, I think Judge Attlee will take charge of the negotiations and make sure everyone gets something."
"Now you're talking. It's worth a shot."
Jake managed a bit of fried okra. Harry Rex was half-finished and eyeing Jake's plate. He said,
"Look, Jake, you played football, right?"
"I tried."
"No, I remember when you were the quarterback for scrawny little Caraway. Never had a winning season, as I recall. What was the worst ass-whooping you ever took on the field?"
"Ripley beat us 50-0 my junior year."
"How bad was it at halftime?"
36-0.
"And did you quit?"
"No, I was the quarterback."
"Okay. You knew at halftime that you were not going to win. But you led the team back onto the field for the second half, and you kept playing. You didn't quit then, and you can't quit now. A win looks pretty doubtful at this point, but you got to drag your ass back onto the field. Right now, you look thoroughly defeated, and the jury is watching every move you make. Eat your vegetables like a good boy, and let's go."